Whether you like history or not, if you care about bravery, wisdom, passion, larger-than-life characters, and some of the most emotionally intense moments in human experience, you have come to the right place. Daniele Bolelli is a university history professor, writer, and martial artist, and he shall be your guide in a journey to the place where history and epic collide.
If you have a problem with me giving thanks to some sponsors ahead of a show, feel free to use the fast forward button because there are quite a few folks I want to thank today. Let's start out with Blue Apron. This episode is brought to you by BlueApron.com. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. They deliver high quality ingredients and recipes right to your door for affordable prices. So check them out and find out for yourself if you could benefit from their services. That's, you know, one easy way to support History on Fire is to take them up on their offer to try 3 free meals with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/onfire. Lately, I've been consuming Blue Apron meals like there's no tomorrow. I still have to run into a single recipe I didn't enjoy like crazy. So I'm not pushing products that I don't actually try myself and enjoy. But don't take my word for it. Check them out for yourself. You get 3 free meals by going to blueapron.com/onfire. And you can find out if they work for you or not. Thank you also to Geek Nation Tours, which is a vacation company which creates tours focusing on geek culture, including conventions, movie locations, and historical battlefields. This time, in October, they will be time-traveling to feudal Japan and the battlefields of Sekigahara. Join them as they watch Kendo, Kyudo, Yaido, and sword-making demonstrations at the Seki Cutlery Festival. They'll visit the most famous Japanese medieval castles, hike through spectacular natural landscapes, and of course visit the Sekigahara Reenactment Festival, where you will see samurai walking the streets in full armor and battling in commemoration of that battle from the 1600s. I'll put the link in the episode notes to their websites, which is geeknationtours.com, but in case you don't have a pen handy, I'll have it ready in the episode notes at historyonfirepodcast.com. Somebody else I'd like to thank. Considering that my audience hails from all over the world and is not really specific to one city, it makes little business sense for a local restaurant to want to sponsor History on Fire. Baleafar Guerrero, owner of Mama Licha's Kitchen in Silmar, California, decided to do that anyway just because he loves the podcast and in particular the topic of this series. So if you find yourself close to Northridge, Burbank, you know, LA, San Fernando Valley, please go check out the restaurant. And if nothing else, even if you are not in the area, which is probably most of you guys, one thing you can do which would be sweet is give a like to his Facebook page. I include the link in the episode notes at historyonfirepodcast.com. The man is not asking for much, just check out his Facebook page, click the like button, and that would be sweet. And of course, last but not least, my two enduring regular sponsors from day one, Onnit and Datsusara. If you are in the market for excellent supplements, workout gear, and other goodies, please go to www.onnit.com/history, where you'll receive an automatic discount. And of course, if you need a computer bag, backpacks, or any other kind of gear made with the finest hemp available, please go to dsgear.com. and use the code Daniele, my name, which is Daniel with an E at the end, at checkout for a discount. If you didn't catch any of the above websites, the links are in the episode notes at historyonfirepodcast.com. As always, at the end of the episode, more on how to support the show and make sure it stays viable, plus future plans for upcoming podcasts, and all the other good stuff. But now, without further ado, let's go set history on fire. Before we get our story rolling, I have three important announcements. In case you haven't heard, I have released a special prequel episode to this series that is not available on iTunes or Stitcher or any of the other formats through which History on Fire is normally distributed. I emailed this episode as a gift to anyone who had donated so far in 2017, but it's also available for sale at historyonfirepodcast.com. The tale basically reads like a cross between The Godfather and The Lion King taking place in pre-Columbian Mesoamerica. It's a powerful story of political intrigue and revenge, featuring characters with flowery names like Nezahualcoyotl, the poet king of Texcoco, or Tezozomoc, a larger-than-life godfather figure whose name meant Angry Stoneface. So if you'd like to check it out, please go get it at historyonfirepodcast.com. Announcement number two. Daryl Cooper from Martyr Made Podcast. By the way, I've mentioned Martyr Made Podcast in the past, but because the name is a very bizarre, curious name, and because my pronunciation is painful, nobody ever has a clue of what I'm saying when I say that word. So, Savannah, please, can you translate for the good folks?
He means to say martyr made.
Thank you very much.
Martyr made.
In any case, now that hopefully you understood what I was trying to say, thank you, Savannah, Daryl Cooper will be running a series of episodes parallel to mine, to this particular series. Daryl is a master podcaster. If you haven't checked it out, his series about the genesis of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it's nothing short of amazing. I mean, he packs one powerful emotional punch in every episode. And in this particular circumstance, he decided he'll be doing a few episodes exploring themes such as human sacrifice and other related ones that... Basically, this series that he'll be doing was conceived as a companion series to the one that I'm starting right now. So if you are in the mood for listening to more of this stuff, check out Daryl. He's amazing. You won't regret it. And last announcement. This is a confession more than announcement. I'm feeling monstrously guilty about this series that is about to begin. Let me explain why. Back when I began History on Fire, I had told the godfather of historical podcasting, Dan Carlin, that I would notify him of what topics I was planning to cover so that he could tell me if he wanted me to skip one of those so that he could cover the topic himself. Dan, being the sweet soul that he is, told me not to worry about it and to pick any topic I wanted. So far so good, but... A few weeks ago I was talking with Dan, and he mentioned that he had thought of covering the Spanish conquest of Mexico, but then voted against it since I was going to tackle the same topic. Hence, my guilt. The thought that I may have deprived the world and myself of a hardcore history series on the Spanish-Aztec clash makes me want to shed bitter tears. Now, those are very manly tears, let's be clear about that, but tears nonetheless. The other thing that this thought does is giving me a heavy sense of responsibility. If I've already done the damage and prevented Dan from covering this topic, then the least I can do is to make this series a truly epic one. So I'm going to give it my all in hopes that you and I can forgive me. I'll start this in a Dan Carlin style with a imagine if kind of scenario. In this case, imagine being captured in battle. Your enemies grab you and they take you away. You are brought to the top of a pyramid, stripped naked, and forced to dance in front of a terrifying statue of Huitzilopochtli, the Aztec war god. As the mob is screaming in a language you don't understand, you're laid on top of sacrificial stone, and a guy with long fingernails and hair covered in blood approaches with an obsidian knife. When he shoves the knife into your chest, you find out that obsidian is indeed as sharp as advertised. He carves out your heart and holds it still pulsing for all to see. Then he sets it on fire. Your body is promptly thrown down the pyramid, where attendants chop you to pieces, and your arms and legs end up being eaten by warriors, along with chili peppers. Safe to say that this is not a very nice way to die. It's also probably safe to say that if you found the above description too disturbing for your taste, you may not want to listen to this series, because things are not going to get any better. There are lots of stories like this one that will be part of the narrative. The tale of the clash between the Spaniards and the Aztecs, Mexica is actually the name we'll use to refer to them here, and I'll explain why soon. But the tale of the clash between these two powers is a powerful, intense, incredibly important story, but also an unbelievably gory one. This is the tale of the clash between two cultures that are quite fond of bloodshed, and of what in the modern world most of us would consider atrocious behaviors. I recently listened again to Dan Carlin's series about World War II on the Eastern Front, and the clash between Nazis and Communists. And in that particular series, Dan opened saying, this is not a story between good guys and bad guys. This is bad guys against bad guys. Same dynamics apply here. Clearly, not all Spaniards and not all Mexica were bad people. Not on an individual level, at least. But their respective cultures were, if seen through modern eyes, kind of despicable. There's a tendency among historians to avoid passing judgment about different cultures in the name of cultural relativism. And yet, it is quite difficult not to do that when faced with the brutality of the Mexica and Spanish cultures in the 1500s. Both were imperialists, both drowned dissent in blood. The version of Catholicism popular in Spain at the time pushed them to burn people alive at the stake for holding different beliefs. Just in Seville alone in the 1480s, it's estimated that over 800 Jewish people were burned at the stake. Mexica religion pushed them to cut out the hearts of thousands of human beings so that they could offer them to their gods. Both cultures, both the Spaniards and the Mexica, were big on class hierarchies. They were characterized by lots of abuses of power by the ruling elites. Their idea of rule, their idea of politics, was that the proper way to rule is you rule through fear. And being subject to either of these people was a miserable experience. Many native people of Mexico had the dubious privilege of being subject to both of them at different times. Let's look now a bit at these cultures before we switch our focus to what will lead to their showdown. Let's start with the home team, the Aztecs. As I mentioned earlier, the term Aztec is the most famous for the powerful Mesoamerican civilization dominating the Valley of Mexico in the 1400s and early 1500s. But the term is also incorrect. Aztec did not become a popular term until the late 1700s. The origin of the term Aztec, which was not used by the people themselves, referred to the origin of these people from their mythical homeland in a place called Aztlan. What these people used for themselves was Mexica, which is what we're going to be using from now on throughout the series. In order to understand Mexica culture, we need to speak at least a little bit about the context in which they emerge on the pages of history. Since this series may end up being monstrously long, I'll do my best to keep this short. Let me give you the 37 seconds crash course in Mesoamerican history. When speaking of Mesoamerican cultures, I'm referring to pre-Columbian cultures sharing many characteristics and occupying the land roughly from modern day Mexico, all the way down to Costa Rica. Here, in this area, it's one of the few places in the world where agriculture was developed independently of other places. It happened in the Middle East, it happened here, not in too many other places around the world. The first evidence we have of people planting seeds and playing an active role in plant reproduction comes from roughly about 9,000 years ago in Mexico. Farming as a lifestyle didn't really emerge until quite a bit later, probably about 5,000 years ago. And it was roughly about 3,500 years ago when the beginning of the Olmec civilization took place in central Mexico. The Olmecs were the first to develop on a large scale the same characteristics that will later be shared by all main Mesoamerican civilizations. They depend on large-scale agriculture. They build ceremonial, monumental architecture, particularly pyramids. They play a ball game involving a rubber ball that is to be shot through a hoop. The concept being similar to basketball, but then the rules and the specifics being quite different. They develop a calendar system. They develop a writing system. And they also develop religious ceremonies centered on sacrifices. The belief that will be quite widespread throughout Mesoamerica is that blood is a life essence, and blood is what feed the gods, and allow in particular the sun god to still move through the sky. If you don't shed blood, there will be no sun, and the crops will die. So people regularly would shed their own blood. They would do, little cuts where they would offer their own blood on a daily basis to the sun god. But also, when you really want to give him a good meal, you also have human sacrifice of your enemies. Captives would be laid on a sacrificial stone, and much like in the description of the opening of this episode, that's basically what will happen. Human sacrifice among these guys usually consisted in a priest digging his knife into your chest and pulling out your heart, Indiana Jones 2 style. Despite all this goriness, Mesoamerican civilizations were quite advanced. There's a mistaken assumption sometimes that advanced also implies some kind of moral advancement. That's not usually what we say when we say the civilization is advanced. It just means technologically advanced. The Spaniards and the Mexica were very advanced for their times. But seen through modern eyes, they produce sadistic sociopaths. The technological advancement has nothing to do with being nice people. And it only has marginally to do with the overall quality of life. It just means more complex. You can build bigger and more complicated things that may or may not be a good thing, depending on other contexts. The Mexica, and in general Mesoamerican civilization, possessed very advanced astronomy and mathematics. They used pictographs and ideograms for writing. Curiously enough, they had no wheels. Rather, they did invent a wheel, but they only used it in toys for children. Why would you have a wheel and use it in toys, but not actually have carts that you can move things with? Well, because having wheeled carts only makes sense if you have large beasts of burden that can drag these carts. And the reality is that in the Americas, there were very, very few domesticated animals, mainly dogs. And as we're going to see, this lack of domesticated animals in the America will be the number one reason that will make the Spanish conquest possible. We'll talk about that later. Also lacking was metallurgy. Some natives of Mexico started working copper and bronze, but most of them didn't, and even those who did were nowhere near the metallurgical magic that would produce Spanish steel. So that was one thing in which they were behind compared to the Spaniards. Following the decline of the Olmec civilization, Mesoamerica saw the rise of too many later civilizations for me to mention. We'll just mention a few. One of the key ones would be the Maya in the southern portion, the coastal southern portion of Mexico. Another big one centered around the city of Teotihuacan, which was give or take about 2,000 years ago, and it would remain a powerful city for several centuries. It was located about 25 miles from modern Mexico City, and it's estimated that in Teotihuacan lived somewhere between 150,000 and 250,000 people, which for those times, that would make it one of the very largest cities in the world at this time, bigger than most anything that existed in Europe. At Teotihuacan, they built spectacular monumental architectures. They still boast the third largest pyramid in the world. The Mexica would be so impressed with the ruins that they found when they crossed that area that they called Teotihuacan the place where the gods were born. Eventually, that civilization collapsed long before the Mexica stepped onto the scene. Some theories suggest due to ecological reasons, others say class conflict. Reality is nobody knows. It's one of those mysteries of history, this big, huge civilization that we know very little about. Another great civilization coming up later were the Toltecs, whose capital Tula was less than 50 miles from modern-day Mexico City, and was at its most powerful between the year roughly 900 and 1150 Common Era. When addressing the rise of the Mexica, it's hard to separate fact from fiction, since one of the Mexica emperors, Itzcoatl, had burned the burning of books in order to rewrite the history. You know, all the early Mexica history, Itzcoatl said, that needs to be gone. Why would he do that? You know, why would he destroy the history of his own people? But probably one of the theories is that he was trying to get rid of the reality of what early Mexica history was like in order to make up a more noble origin and a cooler story for the Mexica past. One of the ideas was the big mystery of where the Mexica came from. As I mentioned earlier, the name of the place was said to be Aztlan. Nobody knows where that is. Some people suggest that it was somewhere in northern Mexico. Other people push it as far north as modern-day southern United States. After all, the Mexica spoke the same Uto-Aztecan language that's spoken even by American tribes such as the Hopi or the Shoshone. It's estimated that the Mexica arrived in the central valley of Mexico in the 1200s, coming somewhere from the north. They had been a nomadic people, and they were coming into an area that was inhabited by much more advanced civilizations. And the more established, sedentary farming societies of the valley of Mexico saw the Mexica as these barbarian newcomers who are not properly cultured. The Valley of Mexico was home to many urban city-states. So the Mexica had to make do with whatever tiny scrap of land they could find. However, despite the fact that they were the latest arrival of the scene and definitely not the most powerful, they did have one thing going for them. The Mexica, by all accounts, were tough as nails, and they were great warriors. So the most powerful states in the area all decided to hire them as mercenary to fight in their wars. Kind of like in ancient Rome, they would hire barbarian mercenaries who were considered uncivilized but really tough. Similar thing, the Mexica are the barbarian of Mexico in this story. I personally like Neil Young a lot as a musician, and he has a song mentioning the Mexica called Cortes the Killer. Neil Young clearly much better as a musician than as a historian, because some of his lyrics read, "Hate was just a legend, and war was never known. The people work together." You know, he's painting this very romanticized, ideal image of what life among the Mexica was before the Spaniards arrived. Yeah, not quite. Fierce competition between city-states in the Valley of Mexico was the norm, and the Mexica were everybody hired muscle. War was as common as among all the other large civilizations around the world. Mexica society, I mean, Mexica culture in particular, was even more warlike than the already warlike culture of the other peoples of the Valley of Mexico. When Mexica boys were born and were named, the midwife would proclaim that they, I quote, belonged to the battlefield, and war was to be their task. In another proclamation, the midwife would say, "Perhaps you will receive the gift of the flower death by the obsidian knife." The flower death being a reference to being sacrificed, which, interesting enough, was something that they considered an honor, which is why the midwife would say, "Perhaps you'll receive the gift of the flower death." The idea being that those who died in sacrifices went to a better afterlife. Infant Mexica boys were also presented with bows and arrows, spears and slings, and also the traditional weapon, which was the macuahuitl, which was basically a big oak club with obsidian blades stuck all along its sides. So Bernal Diaz, a Spaniard who will see them, will compare them to broadswords. And he actually was very impressed with them. He said that they would cut better even than some of the best Spanish swords. So moral of the story, the Mexica were a warrior society through and through. And so not surprisingly, one of their main gods was Huitzilopochtli, the god of war. Later on in Mexica history, upper-class kids would be schooled in academies known as the Houses of Tears, you know, in case there were any doubt about how fun the schooling experience was. Commoners who distinguished themselves as warriors were dispensed from paying tributes and were given land, but typically only the nobles were allowed to use the broadswords. But one way to rise in rank was to capture enemies alive so that they could be sacrificed to the gods. So typically Mexica warriors would try to use obsidian swords or some other cutting implement to cut the hamstring of their enemies, to incapacitate them but not kill them, so that they would then capture them alive and bring them to their temples where they would sacrifice them. So there was a little social mobility through warfare, but there were also some social classes in which you were born which determine a lot of your lot in life. The rigidity of the social system became more so in the 1500s compared to earlier on. Little Mexica girls, on the other hand, were raised to be housewives. Women could own property, so they had that going for them, but they were definitely seen as inferior, culturally speaking. Daughters were commonly given away as presents or to foster political alliances. You know, Mexica culture was rough, definitely. The slogan, "Make love, not war," would have made little sense to the Mexica. Their culture functioned more along the lines of "make war, not love." One of their neighboring population, the Otomi always made fun of the Mexica, thinking that they were kind of prudes about nudity and sexuality in general. You know, they were obviously more comfortable with violence than they were with open sexuality. And in this way, they gained a reputation for barbarism and brutality, even among the human sacrificing militaristic cultures of Mesoamerica. There's a tale in particular that tells you really all you need to know about the Mexica reputation among their neighbors. Story goes that in 1323, they asked the new ruler of Culhuacan, which was an important non-Mexica city in the Valley of Mexico, they asked him to give his daughter in marriage to one of them. And then they said something, you know, it sounded like the standard request that they wanted to create a political alliance by marriage. But they also threw some words mentioning that they wanted to make her into the goddess Yahuciuatl. And the father didn't really pay enough attention to that detail and didn't ask what that meant. Unknown to the king, the Mexica actually planned to sacrifice her. They believed that by doing this, the princess would join the gods as a deity. It probably would have been good to clarify, but in the worst case of miscommunication ever, during a feast attended by both sides, a priest came out, wearing the flayed skin of the princess as part of the ritual. In the Mexica mind, they thought they had paid great honor to the princess and to her father. But the king and the people of Culhuacan did not feel very honored. They were disgusted and thought the Mexica were psychopathic barbarians. This is not exactly the kind of thing you can explain away by blaming a misunderstanding. You know, most people tend to frown on flaying their children, so the Mexica were promptly kicked out of the area. I picture the Mexica at this stage fleeing, all bummed out about the misunderstanding while singing the lyrics from a song made famous by the band The Animals, which say, "I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood." I also imagine the Mexica trying to explain what happened to a third party at a later date, when maybe this third party would ask, "Why are you no longer friends with the people of Culhuacan? You guys used to be so close." And the Mexica would reply something like, "You know, it was all due to this most unfortunate misunderstanding. You know, we thought that flaying their king's daughter and wearing her skin would make them happy. But the craziest thing happened. It turns out it didn't make them happy. How weird." Moral of the story, everyone was pretty horrified at the degree of Mexica taste for blood. In 1325, a couple of years after they got kicked out from this area, they went to the middle of this giant lake that was at the center of the Valley of Mexico and founded the city Tenochtitlan. Later in history, the Mexica would tell the story that they tell kind of a promised land type of story where the gods had sent them to find a homeland, and they would know when they found it, when they would see an eagle sitting on a cactus holding a snake, which incidentally is what's on the Mexican flag today. Most historians believe that the reality is that this is probably a later embellishment on what actually happened, and this was land in the middle of the lake and land that no one wanted. So they later made up the story that they were the true heirs of the Toltecs, the last great civilization. They try to embellish the story a little bit by giving it a mythological aspect to it that many historians don't believe. But then again, maybe it went down exactly as advertised. It's hard to tell. On this island, in the center of the lake, they develop a very interesting system of agriculture. They created what they called the chinampas, which were floating gardens. They cultivated these artificial islands built with mud and anchored to the bed of the lake with trees. So they also had a perfect system of permanent irrigation through seepage. And in this way, the Mexica were able to produce over 100 million pounds of maize per year, plus fruit, veggies, and flowers. So not a bad deal for what in the 1300s were still marginalized people kicked at the edge of the desirable land in the Valley of Mexico. The Mexica exploited the endemic state of warfare pitting the various city-states around the giant lakes at the center of the valley. They hired themselves out as mercenaries and slowly started gaining power and taking out one state after another. They would ally themselves with one state against another, then they would betray their former allies and get rid of them. They eventually developed a triple alliance with two other cities, Texcoco on one side of the lake and Tlacopan, also known as Tacuba, on the other. By the early 1400s, they had become the dominant power in the valley. And by the late 1400s, they were the dominant power even outside of the valley, and by then they had built a true empire controlling much of central Mexico. Tenochtitlan itself, by the mid-1400s, was bigger than probably any city in Europe at this time, except perhaps Naples. Tenochtitlan was built over 2,500 acres of land. Possibly up to 250,000 people lived in it. and the island was connected to the mainland via three causeways. What about the rest of Mexica society? What was going on with them? Well, the new emperor was usually selected among a family of either the previous emperor by an electoral college of nobles, picking the best one among the relatives. Another central institution of Mexica society was known as the Calpulli, which was basically a guild, a mix between a neighborhood association and the guild that owned land and ran some administrative tasks. The Pochteca also, they were the merchants, which were specialized in long-distance trade, and they also served as spies for the empire. Mexica traded all the way to places like Costa Rica and Panama, so quite far. By the early 1500s, the Mexica Empire was stretched to the limit, so it was hard to keep growing, which is kind of a problem for a culture built on aggressive expansion, where the expectation is that you're gonna grow indefinitely. Unfortunately, indefinite growth just doesn't exist in nature, that's not the way life works, and the Mexica were about to find out. One thing that they did to try to avoid the consequences of the stalling of their growth was creating an institution known as the Flower Wars. They started these Flower Wars with towns like Tlaxcala, Cholula, and a few others. And basically the Flower Wars were ritualized battles with formal rules, designed not so much to kill enemies as much as to provide military experience for their warriors, and most importantly, to capture victims to be sacrificed on their respective altars. So the Mexica allowed some of the cities to remain independent so that they could have these wars for military experience and sacrifices. Or at least that's what the Mexica said. Some of the people from the city said that they didn't allow them to remain independent. It's just they were too strong to be conquered. So that's a bit of a disagreement in the sources there. But let's go back at least briefly to Mexica religion. They believed that not only an apocalypse was about to happen, but also that previous apocalypses had already happened. They believed that the first world ever created was destroyed by wild animals. The second was created destroyed by wind, the third by fire, and the fourth by floods. The fifth world, which is the one that they were living in, would be destroyed by earthquakes. The only way to keep this outcome at bay was to make a deal with Huitzilopochtli, the war god who was also associated with the sun. The war god was assisted by the spirits of warriors who had died in battle or as sacrifices, and by women who had died in childbirth. The one theory is that Huitzilopochtli was not as important in early Mexica history as it will become in later Mexica history, when warfare in general grows in importance. Kind of like Viking myths about the eventual end of the world, the Mexica had a fairly negative worldview. Even the richest Mexica believed that ultimately everything was destined to collapse. You know, just a few miles away, the ruins of Teotihuacan, who I mentioned a few minutes ago, reminded everybody that all great civilization can collapse. You know, no one even remembered what language they spoke at Teotihuacan or even who they were, and yet clearly they had been very impressive in their time. Still speaking of Mexica religion, their priests were usually celibates, either dedicated to Huitzilopochtli or another one of the Aztec gods, Tlaloc, the rain god. The old Mexica gods were mixed with some of the gods of the people of the Valley of Mexico, so it's hard to tell what came first. But one theory is that they believed, though, that all the different gods were really manifestation of a single supernatural force. Beside this form of state animism, the state religion with the priest and the sacrifices and the pyramids, also Mexica religion was characterized by shamanic specialists who operated more informally at the village level. These guys were those who would interpret dreams, perform healing, sometimes predict the future. They would enter the state of altered consciousness thanks to the use of pulque, tobacco, hallucinogenic mushrooms, plants like datura, peyote. Mushrooms in particular grew all over the pine-covered mountains around the valley, and the Mexica consumed these mushrooms quite enthusiastically. There's a story that when the temple of Huitzilopochtli was dedicated in Tenochtitlan in 1487, that thousands of people were sacrificed in a matter of days. Some Spaniards reported seeing over 100,000 skulls found in Tenochtitlan belonging to sacrificial victims. Others say that these numbers are grossly exaggerated. So there's debate on the exact number. There is no debate about the fact that it did happen, and on a larger scale than what typical Mesoamerican peoples did. As odd as Mexica religion may strike you, there are actually quite a few similarities with the kind of Catholicism practiced in Spain at this time. You know, think about the way it looked from a Mexica perspective. Catholicism was based on a guy nailed to a cross, shedding blood in sacrifice to redeem the world. And the Mexica had a religion that was based on the notion that you need to offer blood in sacrifice for the cosmic order to keep functioning. Self-torture through the offering of blood was common among the Mexica, and self-flagellation, shedding blood, was really not that uncommon among Spaniards at this time. Both the Aztecs, or the Mexica and the Spaniards, were fairly tough militaristic societies. You know, the Mexica performed human sacrifice on a massive scale, and among the Spaniards, things like the Inquisition were quite popular. More interestingly, the religious belief of both the Spaniards and the Mexica pushed them toward militarism and conquering other peoples. You know, the Mexica needed to expand because they needed more sacrifices to be captured among enemies so that you could feed the gods. The Spaniards were animated by this ideology of holy war that's common to all Western religion, that basically sees all of history as a fight between God and the devil, and that conquering other cultures was a way to expand God's kingdom. In some way, Spanish culture was also influenced by the history of the Reconquista. You know, they have been conquered and dominated by Muslims for several centuries, and over a long period of time, they had slowly fought their way back until they kicked out the Muslims from the peninsula and they turned it again into a Catholic kingdom. So this idea of religious warfare was quite common for both of these peoples. The writings of the Spanish conquistadors are regularly filled with justifications for doing this in the name of God. Hernán Cortés, one of the key characters in this series, he once wrote a letter to the King of Spain saying, "And we believe that not without cause has God been pleased to allow this land to be discovered in the name of your royal majesties, that your majesties may reap great merit and reward from him in sending the gospel to this barbarian people, who thus, by your majesty's hands, will be received into the true faith. For from what we know of them, we believe that by the aid of the interpreters, who should plainly declare to them the truths of the holy faith and the error in which they are, many, perhaps all of them, who very quickly depart from their evil ways and would come to the true knowledge." Clearly, you know, expanding, bringing Catholicism to the New World was not the only reason for conquering. Greed was much, you know, was certainly an important one. I don't know if it was more important, but it was up there with the desire for religious conversion. And it's certainly pushing the religious interpretation sounds a lot better when trying to justify conquest. The reality was probably a mix of both. Bernal Diaz captured this perfectly when he wrote, "We came to serve God and get rich." That's a great line right there. We came to serve God and get rich. It's like, yeah, you know, we're serving God, but if we happen to make some money along the way, that won't be such a bad thing. I'm kind of fascinated by the similarities between Mexica and Mexica religion and Catholicism. Apparently, I'm not the only one. There's the writer Graham Hancock, in his trilogy about, he wrote a series of novels about the Spanish conquest of Mexico, and in one of them called The War God, he posits the following scenarios. He says, look, Moctezuma, the Mexica emperor, would regularly take hallucinogenic mushroom and receive, whether he believed it or would, you know, he said that he received directions from the war god, and these directions usually required him to do horrible things to other people. Cortes similarly said that he received messages from San Peter, also telling him to do fairly horrible things in the process of conquest. So Gramanco, tongue-in-cheek, or maybe not, suggests that there was an actual supernatural force out there communicating with Cortes and with Moctezuma. But no, it was not a god. It was a demon thriving on human suffering, who was appearing with different faces to Cortes and to Moctezuma, but basically being one and the same. Now, whether one believes in such things or not, one thing is undeniable. The meeting between Cortes and Moctezuma is a contest between monsters. And when I say monsters, I don't mean to say that they did not possess some admirable qualities, perhaps. But it's kind of difficult to focus on those qualities in the face of the fact that they were religious fanatics, claiming divine guidance as the source behind immense amounts of bloodshed that they will both unleash on other people. So, there's that. Take it as you will. As we begin the journey that will lead to the clash between Mexica and Spaniards, let's consider our sources for a second. One of the key sources are the writings from people like Bernal Diaz and a few other conquistadors. Diaz wrote a book when he was over 70 years old, and he was the last survivor of the expedition. He was originally born in 1492. He had been in Panama in 1514, and had later been a member of both the Cordoba and Grijalva expeditions that preceded Cortes in Mexico. There aren't preserved any contemporary Mexica perspectives. The best we have are some interviews. They were conducted by young Mexica long after the conquest had completed. They went to find some of the older Mexica, and under the supervision of a priest, they interviewed them and asked them their opinions. Now, an obvious problem is that these guys were not exactly able to speak freely, since they were under Spanish domination at the time, and, you know, this is a time of Inquisition and similar things, so it's possible that they were just telling the Spaniards what they wanted to hear. It's also possible that maybe they were interpreting the events with 2020 vision in sight of what had happened later that they had already lived through. And to complicate things further, some of them were the sons of priests. The priest had supposed to be in charge of avoiding an outcome like what happened, to be able to predict what was going to happen and advise Moctezuma. So it's likely that many of them may have wanted to emphasize this sense of inevitability about the whole thing, to avoid taking the blame. In any case, they will clearly never know. Most sources hint at a foreshadowing of the encounter between the Mexica and the Spaniards through a series of rather eerie omens. The omens began, well, first, before even the omens, they were in 1510, a trunk full of clothes, jewels, and a sword was brought to Tenochtitlan from the Gulf of Mexico, where it had been found. And this generated lots of mystery because nobody had seen such things before. This was clearly something that had fell off a Spanish ship, had made its way to the coast of Mexico, and leaving people rather puzzled about its contents. And it was around this time when the omens began. The first of the omen was that they said there was a fire in the sky, likely what that means, a comet, that was seen every night for a year. Another one was the temple of Huitzilopochtli caught fire on top of the pyramid, and the Mexica tried to put out the fire but couldn't, and the whole thing burned to the ground. Apparently Mexica temples were not in luck at this time, because in another occasion another temple was struck by lightning at a time when there was no thunder and very little rain, and so people took it as some kind of sign from the gods. They saw something else that looked like a comet. They saw, in one particular occasion, the water from the lake started foaming, despite the fact that there was no wind. And it bubbled and made these exploding sounds, flooding some houses and destroying them. Dramatically increasing the creepy factor is omen number six. Night after night, the many Mexica reported hearing this crying by this unidentified woman, who would be walking the street of Tenochtitlan in the middle of the night, screaming, "Oh, my beloved sons, we're all going to die." And in case you're already too happy after hearing this first thing in the middle of the night, "Oh, my children, where shall I hide you?" You know, not the kind of, if you hear that outside your window in the middle of the night, it's safe to say that it does not give you a good night's sleep. The omens get weirder and weirder. At one point, the tale goes that some fisherman brought a bird looking kind of like a crane with a mirror on its head. And the story is that Montezuma looked into this mirror and saw the heavens and the stars and men riding on what appeared to be deer approaching for war. He asked some of his advisors for interpretation, but by the time they turned around to look at the bird had disappeared. Again, on the weird factor, some two-headed people are supposed to have been brought to Moctezuma, who put them in his zoo, but they disappeared. It's interesting historically. If you look cross-culturally, you see this story about omens predicting some dramatic thing in many cultures. If you read about the death of Julius Caesar, there's the same thing about these omens, you know, these things that have been seen in the sky that had happened in multiple occasions around Rome. And who knows? I mean, maybe something did happen. Some will say that the omens are things that are made up later, since people feel better if the sequence of events was predestined, and then that's why they couldn't do anything about it. Nobody knows, of course. I'm just telling you the story as reported in the sources. A different source also tells us that some old people approached Moctezuma, saying that they had terrible dreams that he should know about. They told him their dreams about the eventual destruction of Tenochtitlan and the collapse of the cult of Huitzilopochtli. And Moctezuma, not being a big believer in the don't kill the messenger principle, decided to throw them in jail to starve them to death. And one source then tells us, not surprisingly, after this, no one wished to tell his dream to Moctezuma. You think? Moctezuma also sent his men to bring into his palace men who had the reputation as shamans and medicine men. He asked them about the omens, and when they said that they did not see them, he threw them in prison. At that point, one of them told him, "Let Montezuma know, in one word, what is to become of him. Those who are to avenge the injuries and toils with which he has afflicted us are already on their way. I say no more." Moctezuma was already a bit nervous about all this omen business. He's described as being very fearful at this time, even more so because the same gloomy message had been delivered to him by his political ally, the king of Texcoco. So Moctezuma ordered his men to interrogate the shamans who had imprisoned, but they disappeared overnight from a heavily guarded prison. The head steward went back to Montezuma with the news, and Mexica sources from years later report that he spoke these words. He said, "My lord, command that I be cut to pieces, or whatever else you wish. For you must know, my lord, that when I arrived and opened the doors, no one was there. I have special guards at the prison, trustworthy men who have served me many years, but none of them heard them escape. I myself believe that they flew away, for they know how to make themselves invisible, which they do every night, and can fly to the ends of the earth. This is what they must have done." You know, he finished this sentence, and his life was hanging in the balance. Moctezuma didn't take it well, but somehow decided not to kill his steward. Instead, he passed the following order. tear down their houses, kill their wives and children, and dig in the places where the houses had been until you reach the water. All their possessions are to be destroyed, and if any of them is ever seen in a temple, he is to be stoned and his body thrown to the wild beasts." You can tell that Moctezuma was not the most pleasant guy. You really didn't want to get on his bad side. A historian named Stuart Schwartz has the following to say. "Although these omens appear pre-Columbian and indigenous in origin, a closer look raises some questions. There is evidence suggesting that the Nahua peoples were not alarmed by the arrival of the Spaniards, and rather than viewing them as an almost supernatural force, they saw them as simply another group of powerful and dangerous outsiders who needed to be controlled or accommodated." So he kind of pushes the idea that the omens were made up later, that they were not real. But if we are to believe the omen story, there's also a tale saying that the old king of Texcoco, named Nezahualpilli, who, incidentally, he was the son of Nezahualcoyotl, who is the protagonist of the special prequel to this series. That particular prequel is only available on History on Fire podcast website and nowhere else. In any case, his son, Nezahualpilli, was now an old man, had been the old king of Texcoco for a while. He was famous for being very wise and being a great astrologer who could look at the stars and predict the future, and he said terrible things are coming. He predicted the collapse of the Mexica. Moctezuma tried to protest, saying, "Hey, my advisors have different interpretations. They don't think that these omens are so bad." The king of Texcoco said, "You know what? Let's have a ball game. Let's find out who is right about the interpretation of the omens. We'll play best of five, whoever wins three. And whoever wins, the gods are on their side, and that interpretation is the correct one." So Moctezuma, they decided, okay, let's have this ball game. It's funny picturing these middle-aged to older gentlemen stripping down to the basics to just play this very rough ball game. And Moctezuma won the first two games, but in a stunning comeback, Nezahualpilli won the remaining three, quite bumming out Moctezuma, who not only lost the game, but now had to entertain the possibilities that maybe the omens were as terrifying as Nezahualpilli had said. You know, all these reports of white people with beards being seen on the coast are scaring the hell out of him. You know, so that's where we leave Moctezuma at this time. By the way, who was this Moctezuma we keep talking about? He was the second of his name to be a Mexica emperor. He was Moctezuma II. About 50 years old in 1518. He was a big believer in ruling through fear, not love, and when he first had assumed the throne in 1502, he had all the people of lower rank who had served the previous emperor dismissed from their post, because he was extremely class conscious and only wanted noble people working close to him. Because he was bastard, it wasn't enough for him to fire them, but he had them all killed. He would often order executions without an apparent rhyme or reason, just to test the loyalty of his ministers. When he wasn't busy killing people, he liked jugglers, dwarves, music. He had a whole lot of wives. It's estimated that the sources say that the least he had was 19 children, and some of the more generous ones gave him 150 children. So not a big believer in family planning. But let's now turn to the other side of this encounter. Let's take a look at the ranks of the Spaniards. A key character in our story will be Diego de Velázquez. Velázquez was governor of Cuba. We'll hear more about him. Let's just stick with governor of Cuba for now. Another important character who had played a role in early Spanish colonization was Vasco Núñez de Balboa, who Bernal Díaz was one of the key sources for the whole series. In 1514, he had gone out to the first Spanish settlement on the mainland. You know, up until this time, After 1492, the Spaniards had been conquered all the islands in the Caribbean. But in 1514, they started expanding. Actually, even a few years earlier, Diaz arrived in 1514, but even earlier, they had started expanding into the area of modern-day Panama. When Diaz arrived, the governor of the settlement was about to become the father-in-law of this Vasco Núñez de Balboa, who had played a key role in colonizing the place. But he decided that Balboa was not so trustworthy, so he had him executed for rebellion in 1519. So that was the stuff that was going on in Panama. In the meantime, Velázquez in Cuba decided to... He heard all these rumors about the mainland from the guys who'd gone in Panama. They heard that there may be big civilizations further north. So he paid for an expedition to be headed by a guy by the name of Francisco Hernández de Córdoba. The Córdoba was going to lead... It would be wrong to call it a Spanish army. Most of the Spaniards technically were not professional soldiers here, but professional armies in the modern sense were pretty rare back then. These were volunteers trained to different degrees in using weapons, some of them very skilled. Córdoba had petitioned Velázquez to lead an expedition in search of new lands, and according to some historians, to look for slaves. Bernal Diaz would be a member of this expedition and the author of one of the best accounts of the whole conquest as a participant. He tells kind of a weird story about this Córdoba expedition. He said that Velázquez had approved the expedition on the condition that they first go fight on islands off the coast of Honduras, enslave some of the local natives and sell them to him. So far, nothing weird. The weird part is that Córdoba's men are supposed to have refused on moral grounds to do that. And Velázquez said, okay then, just go do the expedition anyway. This is very weird, because the Spaniards are not exactly shy about enslaving people in the early 1500s. It's likely that Diaz changed his tune when he wrote decades after this fact, when there was a lot more opposition to slave-catching expeditions. So he may have tried to clean up the record of what he was doing on the Córdoba ship to begin with. In Cuba by now, the local native population had been so wiped out that there were not enough natives to enslave, to prosper on the slave trade. So many historians think that the whole Diaz, no, we weren't really looking for slaves, is a made-up justification, and the Córdoba expedition was largely about slave catching. Not sure, in either case, whether it was for slaves or to look for new lands, the Córdoba expedition did happen in February 1517. With 110 men and 3 ships, Córdoba left Cuba and headed out toward the mainland. They landed at a place off the coast of Mexico called Isla Mujeres, because mujeres being the Spanish term for women, and that's because they saw lots of statues of goddesses were found there. From there, they made their way to the Yucatan Peninsula in southern Mexico. There they ran into some local Maya people who arrived in canoes, and yet they couldn't really talk to each other because the Spaniards didn't speak Maya, the Maya didn't speak Spanish, there were no interpreters. Maya culture had been, Maya civilization had been quite powerful, but was a bit in decline by now. They did practice human sacrifice, not quite on the same scale as the Mexica. Different Maya tribes hated each other, kind of like that same city-state scenario I was describing earlier for the Valley of Mexico. The tale goes that the following day after this initial encounter, Córdoba decided to follow the Maya to shore. But when he and some of his men entered the forest, they were attacked by Maya warriors. Wounded over 15 Spaniards. However, the Spaniards were able, thanks to their guns and swords and crossbows, to scare the remaining Maya into fleeing. Bernal Diaz writes the following. He said, "Wielding their lances in both hands, they did us great damage. But thanks be to God, when they felt the sharp edge of our swords and the effect of our crossbows and muskets, they quickly took to their heels, leaving 15 dead on the field. The Spaniards moved on, found an abandoned Maya town where they saw temples and, again, in Diaz's account, these contain many idols of baked clay, some with demons' faces, some with women's faces, and others equally ugly, which seem to represent Indians committing sodomy with one another. Just to be safe, the Spaniards stole the statues and whatever gold they could find and captured two Maya, which they name Melchior and Julian, and left the area. The plan was to train these guys to be interpreters to learn some Spanish so that they would help in the future. They kept sailing along the coast, so more pyramids, more coastal towns. By late March, they arrived at a different spot on the coast of Yucatan. They stopped on the coast at this place where they were invited by the local Maya to visit. Similar story, they went to their towns, they saw their altars covered in blood. Apparently the Maya just sacrificed some people to ensure victory in case there was a battle with the Spaniards. The Spaniards were quite grossed out, seeing the priest with their hair clotted with blood, in the word of Diaz, like a horse's braided mane. However, despite the eerie goriness of the setting, the Maya offered them food and pulque. The Maya also fumigated the Spaniards with incense, possibly because they stunk. You know, the Spaniards were not exactly big on personal hygiene in the 1500s, and they were roaming around the jungle covered in armor. So yeah, they were probably not the best smelling people ever. Cordoba left with the gift of a few gold jewels that the Maya had acquired through trade from somewhere else, and they gave them to the Spaniards. These very much turned on the Spanish desire to explore more. Eventually, however, the Spaniards wore out their welcome, and the Maya started burning a torch, saying through gestures that, "Be gone before the fire is out, or else." The Spaniards didn't want to find out what "or else" meant, so they left. 6 days later, they stopped at a town called Champoton. Diaz sometimes referred to it as Potonchan, same place. Here, some of the Spaniards go on shore to search for fresh water, and they see groups of warriors approaching in silence with feathers in their hair, faces painted black, white, and red. They spent an uneasy night hearing warriors congregating nearby. All night they heard the beating of drums, playing of flutes, shouting. A Maya chief moved his forces so that by dawn they had surrounded the outnumbered Spaniards. This will become known as the Battle of Champoton. With war cries, the Maya let everybody know that they were meant business. They would beat their mouths with their hands in a way to release this war cry. The Maya warriors were equipped primarily with stone and copper axes. They used the slings to cast stones. They used bow and arrows. And of course they had wooden clubs with obsidian blades stuck in it. In the fighting to take place, 80 Spanish soldiers were wounded. Bernal Diaz himself was hit with 3 different arrows, one of them catching him in the ribs. Cordoba, their leader, walked away with 33 wounds on his body. 2 Spaniards were captured alive and very likely sacrificed. All in all, about 20 Spaniards were killed. Some people say over 50 of them, which would have been half the expedition. In either case, this is a big loss for the Spaniards, so they promptly fled to their boats. This was the first Spanish defeat in North America. Well, or Central America, however you want to consider this part of Mexico. In the following days, the Spaniards were still short of water. They were nearly crazy with thirst, so they would have to get water from a creek with lots of alligators, because they didn't dare to make a landing at a safer place. Many got sick because of the poor quality of the water. Because of the winds, they couldn't just go straight back to Cuba, so they made a detour landing in what will become Florida. Also here they were attacked by local Indians. They fought it out, one of the Spaniards again was captured in Florida now, and by now they decide they have seen enough and they make their way back to Cuba. In the meantime, that guy Melchior, one of the Maya they had captured, who started learning a little Spanish, told them a story that he said that there were some Christians in the hands of a Maya chief in some of the towns they had passed by. We'll go back to that story in a little bit. Cordoba couldn't make much use of this information because he died of his wounds within days of arriving in Cuba. Now, Velázquez was not happy with the monstrous failure of the Cordoba expedition, so he decided to appoint his nephew, Juan de Grijalva, was about 28 years old at this time, to launch a second expedition. He would bring Melchior and Julian with him as interpreters, and would have as captain Pedro de Alvarado, who would play a big role throughout our series. Alvarado was, he apparently was a big fan of very gaudy clothing, and he wore gold, giant gold chains around his necks and lots of gold rings on his fingers. Picture him basically as the 1500s equivalent of a gangster rapper who had finally made his bling and he can show off all the good stuff. That's kind of the way Alvarado, that was his style. Also, a couple of the other captains were Francisco de Montejo and Alonso de Avila. They left in April of 1518 with 240 men, so a much bigger expedition. They first arrived at this island of Cozumel, where there was the shrine to this goddess Ischel, also known as the Lady of the Rainbow, patroness of medicine and sex. There, a local chieftain came aboard Grijalva's boat and was given some wine, and they started trading. The Spaniards came on shore, but many of the Maya hidden away. So the Spaniards just walked through this deserted Maya town, and there they met what they describe as a beautiful Jamaican Indian girl, a native girl originally from Jamaica, who she spoke the same language as the indigenous people who spoke in Cuba, so most of the soldiers understood what she was saying. She told the story that 2 years before, she and 10 men had gone out in a fishing canoe in an expedition, but the current had took them to these islands. The local indigenous people had killed their husband and sacrificed all the other men, and only she had been allowed to live. So she quickly joined the Spaniards. Together they climbed the pyramid in the middle of town and they raised the Spanish flag and read this document known as the Requerimiento, which was a rather funny document because the Requerimiento was this thing that the Spaniards were supposed to read everywhere they went, that in theory gave the native people a choice. It said, you can either become our subjects and just pay tribute and to the king of Spain, or if you refuse, then it's our right to start a war with you and wipe you out and enslave you. Which in itself is not the greatest choice, right? It's like, do you want to be my subject or do you want me to kill you? Sort of like, can I get the third envelope? Because none of those two choices sound so good. But to make it even funnier, usually the requerimiento was read either in Spanish or Latin. Neither language clearly was spoken by the locals. So, you know, the Spaniard just did this because somebody back home felt that it was more humane to go about conquering this way. And, you know, some Spanish soldier would read this thing thinking, okay, let's be done with the formalities before we can take care of business. At this moment, while they were going through this old ceremony, a Maya chief walked back into town. He presented a rather interesting sight. His toes were cut off. The story they heard was that a shark had bitten them off in the past. And he came up the temple to make his offering to the gods completely ignoring all the Spaniards around him. Grijalva, in response to this religious challenge, ordered one of his priests to celebrate Mass. So the Maya started coming back into town, but there was this uneasy feeling. You know, they gave Grijalva some gifts, turkeys, honey, some food. And he replied something along the lines of, yeah, that's sweet and all, but where's the gold? Problem is, the Maya did not have much gold. Despite this, they had a feast together. Days later, Grijalva set sail again and they moved to an area where a couple of Spaniards who had, as we'll find out, there were a couple of Spaniards who had survived a shipwreck years prior, but Grijalva didn't know about it. Don't worry though, these guys will show up in our story before too long. Grijalva went back to Champoton, that same place where the Spaniards had already had trouble with the Maya. The Maya were polite, gave them some food, but they, in no uncertain term, asked them to leave. Grijalva ignored them and decided to spend the night there anyway. So throughout the night, round two of the battle preparation, same story with the drums and the shouting and all of them. And it was odd because some Maya would visit the Spanish camps and dance to flutes played by the Spaniards. So there was this confusion between seeming friendliness and hostility. But hostility prevailed and the Maya eventually showed up painted in black and white with a chief carrying the torch, which apparently was their classic sign to give somebody a chance to get out of town. And they told them, look at this torch, we're gonna light it and place it between our armies. If you don't get out quickly and retreat before the torch is burned, you will die. We do not want you as guests. So the message was not exactly ambiguous. Grijalva doesn't want to listen, so a battle begins. Grijalva placed the cannon on top of the pyramid to be able to mow down some of the Maya warriors from a higher ground. One estimate tells us that as a result of this battle, 60 Spaniards were wounded and 7 were killed, but that the Maya lost many more men and that fled. After this battle, the Spaniards just go up the coast. And during the hunting expedition up the coast, by mistake, they left, according to different version, either a mastiff or a greyhound dog there. And they capture some 4 local natives. So every so often they stop, have a little interaction with the natives, sail up the coast, stop again. They eventually stopped in an area that was colonized by the Mexica, where the local natives paid tribute to the Mexica. And they had fairly, you know, their encounter with the Spaniards was friendly. You know, these particular people were known as the Totonacs. Much like the Mexica, these guys on a daily basis, they would draw blood for offerings to the sun. But they had a friendly interaction with the Spaniards. They would smoke tobacco together, give them food. Even the Mexica Emperor Moctezuma, his ambassadors ended up showing up on the scene and they exchanged gifts with the Spaniards. In the following days, Grijalva and his men left toward an island where they found 5 Indians who had been recently sacrificed. In the words of Bernal Diaz, here we found 5 Indians who had been sacrificed to them on that very night. Their chests had been struck open and their arms and thighs cut off, and the walls of these buildings were covered in blood. They go to a different island and more evidence of sacrifice over there. That's not what bothered them, though apparently there were too many mosquitoes for the Spanish taste, so that's why they got out. Grijalva at this stage sent his captain Alvarado back to Cuba to bring back all those men who had been wounded. Later, at this point, they had I'm gonna skip all the details because they have a few fights with local natives, trade, you know, this whole pattern keep happening and happening. Some of the Spaniards were not happy with Grijalva leadership. One of them wrote, "Had we had a resourceful captain, we should have got over 2,000 castellanos out of this. But with Grijalva in command, we could not carry out barter, nor settle the land, nor do anything good." So by the time Alvarado got back to Cuba, he told the governor that Grijalva was a terrible leader. So the governor was upset and, you know, started thinking about possibly a third expedition. So the third expedition, okay, first one was a huge failure, second one wasn't that great either. So for the third expedition, the governor of Cuba picked Hernán Cortés. Cortés will be the key character in our story. He was born either in 1484, some sources tell us, 1485, so he would have been in his early to mid-30s around this time. And he had grown up in Spain, in a place where there were both Christians, Muslims, and Jews lived there, had nearly died in childbirth, but the midwife was able to save him and gave credit for the fact that the boy was able to survive to St. Peter, which was why Cortés was so loyal to this saint. One of his favorite sayings was, "Fortune favors the brave," which was a reference from an ancient Roman play, the Phormio. He had been supposed to go to the New World several times before he actually did, but he was a playboy and suffer from the incidents that were part of the job. In one occasion, he fell from a wall after climbing out of some lady's window before her enraged husband would show up. He had toyed with the idea of becoming Cesare Borgia's bodyguard, but eventually ruled against it. He was, you know, there are many ambitious people in history. Cortés is high up on the list. In 1504, he had arrived into the New World at Santo Domingo originally. He had become a notary. He had a fight with some other Spaniards, which left a scar on his chin. And he was fond of telling his friends that he would eventually, I quote, "either dine to the sound of trumpets or die on the scaffold." In other words, he was gonna try big. Either having great success or miserable failure. There was not going to be boredom or a mediocre life was not going to be his destiny. He joined Velázquez in Cuba in 1511, and Velázquez originally was fairly generous to him. He gave him some land, some slaves. Cortés had a daughter by an enslaved Indian girl. In 1514, some problems with Velázquez began. Cortés sided with some settlers who were angry with Velázquez, saying that he need to hand out more native slaves. Velázquez, upset with that Cortés had taken the side against him, stripped him of his position as his secretary and sent him under arrest to Santo Domingo, but he eventually pardoned him. Troubles, however, were not over because shortly thereafter they got into another fight. As we have already established, Cortés was an old dog, and as an old dog, he had seduced Catalina Suárez. In some version, they refer to her as Juárez, some version Suárez. She was the sister-in-law of the governor, and he, Cortés being Cortés, had promised to marry her, but wasn't so hot on the idea the morning after. So, you know, he, and to make things even worse, not only he had seduced her and decided, yeah, I'm not really marrying you, but on top of it, he had already started the process of trying to get under the skirts of another one of their sisters. So Velázquez was mad. He put pressure on Cortés. He jailed him for several months. Cortés escaped, but he was arrested again by Juan Escudero, who will play a role in our story later. Eventually, Velázquez agreed to pardon him only if Cortés agreed to marry Catalina. So I guess marriage is better than jail. And there was that. That's how Cortés ended up being married to Catalina Suárez. Now they were buddy-buddy again. Governor Velázquez authorized Cortés to launch an expedition. Cortés had a weird background for this. He had never commanded men in battle. You know, he was not a soldier. He was a lawyer, actually. Actually, not even a lawyer, technically. He had dropped out of law school, which may be interesting life advice for some of you guys. If you find yourself flunking out of law school, going on to conquer an empire may be a good alternative. Cortés had participated in just a couple of battles under Velázquez, and as the leader of the expedition, he would have to finance at least part of it. Part of it would be Velázquez, part of it would be him. Velázquez wrote these instructions saying that the principal purpose of the expedition was to serve God, so blasphemy, cards, and sex with native women would be banned. He gave some bizarre instruction in telling Cortés to find out about the truth regarding the Amazons or the possibility that he had heard that there were people who had faces like dogs on the mainland. All sort of wild stories circulating at this time. Cortés said, Amazon check, dog face people check, we'll take care of it, don't worry. He recruited that same Pedro de Alvarado, who had played an important role in the previous expedition. But stirring up trouble, while they were walking to church, Velázquez and Cortés, they were walking together toward church. A guy who was known as a practical trickster approached Velázquez and kept joking about how Cortés was going to run away with the fleet. It's very likely that this guy had been paid by some of Velázquez's relatives who were jealous of Cortés. Realizing that Velázquez may change his mind quickly, Cortés decided to hurry to get out of town. Velázquez was beginning to worry that when he realized that Cortés' preparations seemed to indicate a much grander task than the one assigned to him. And Cortés, realizing that Velázquez may revoke the commission any minute, hurried up. Velázquez had it. He said, I don't trust Cortés so much, so actually I'm going to give the job to a different guy, a certain Luis de Medina. However, Cortés' brother-in-law, Juan Suárez, decided to follow the messenger that Velázquez had sent to this Luis Medina and make him go away. He just stabbed him on a deserted road and dumped his body in a ravine and promptly took the papers that were appointing de Medina the task of the expedition. So he brought the papers back to Cortés. So Cortés now knew that time was running out. You know, his own brother-in-law murdered somebody, a messenger from Velázquez. He by now, by reading the message, found out that Velázquez was planning to get rid of him and instead appoint somebody else in charge. So Cortés sent some of his men to go to the town's slaughterhouse and forcing the owner of the slaughterhouse to sell all of his meat. They took the pigs, the cows, the sheep, you name it. Cortés left his wife and his house with very little concern. And at this point, you know, the owner of the slaughterhouse ran up to Velázquez telling him what happened. So Velázquez and this guy ran to the docks to try to see Cortés. But Cortés, not being stupid, had already prepared everything and they were in the boat, ready to sail. So yelling from the docks, Velázquez said, How is this, my friend, that you are setting off in this way? Is this a good way to say goodbye to me? Remember what I had said about the liberal use of the word my friend in the Crazy Horse episode? In that episode, No Water had just finished using those words when he shot Crazy Horse in the face for making out with his wife. And in this case, the my friend by Velázquez is equally disingenuous, since Velázquez and Cortés by now distrusted and hated each other. In any case, Cortés yelled back from the boat, Forgive me, but these things have all been thought about some time before they were ordered. Were not your orders? And by now they were probably too far away to continue the communication. So Cortes and his men sailed off on November 18, 1518. They sent a ship to Jamaica to acquire more provisions for the expedition. They sent letters to some of the magistrates in the other islands. And somehow, Cortes had crazy diplomatic ability, so he convinced some of the captains of his expedition, some of whom were loyal to Velázquez, he convinced them to stay with him, and even convinced one of Velázquez's messengers to join. Cortes apparently was quite a charming speaker. Years later, Cortes openly admitted, I'll quote from him, he said, "By my faith, I carried on over there as if I had been a gentlemanly pirate." He flat out said that he was kind of a pirate. The expedition was not something that was officially sanctioned by the Spanish crown. This was a private enterprise. They had a whole lot of sailors who would be paid, most of them Italian. The soldiers were not paid. They were just provided food, and they were with the expectation that they would divide any profit from the expedition. So profit was clearly a primary goal of the whole thing. Cortes had with him about, initially at least, 530 Europeans, including some specialists in the use of the crossbow and in the use of the 1500 version of guns. European warfare was changing quickly thanks to the technological transformation. The Italian condottiere Paolo Vitelli had gouged the eyes and cut the hands of captured German gunners because he was disgusted with the idea that a knight could be killed by common men with guns. Cortes, instead, was not such a traditionalist as to refuse guns. So he brought guns, he brought 14 cannons. They had a few women travel with them, a couple of sisters of one of his captains, a few maids. Also with them were several hundred Cuban Indians and some enslaved African Americans. Melchior, that same Maya interpreter, was with them. They had a few horses and several war dogs. I'll skip for now the name of all the captains, not to avoid confusing you too much. Some of them were less than fond of Cortes. One of them, this Diego de Ordaz, commented about Cortes saying he had no more conscience than a dog. And in another comment, he said he was addicted to women in excess. Cortes was funny because he was honestly religious. He was a real Catholic. He combined Catholic beliefs with a lot of pragmatism. There was a mix of religion and womanizing and greed. They were all part of who he was. You know, you would be wrong to say that he was not a truly devoted man. Not that being a very devoted man made him less enthusiastic about lies, pillage, murder and rape, all activities that he vigorously dedicated himself to in the following months. But, you know, there are ways to justify it. If it's in the service of the Lord, pretty much anything can be justified. Or at least that's the way Cortes saw it. The fact that he brought cannons and horses indicates that he wasn't planning on just trading. He had bigger goals in mind. After encountering some rough weather, Cortes reached the island of Cozumel. Alvarado arrived there first and seized some food and captives and some jewels from the temple. So when Cortes arrived and found that Alvarado had already done this, he was pretty mad. He found a woman in town after all the Maya had fled due to Alvarado's violence. So Cortes covered her in gifts and said he apologized and said to invite our people back. Slowly the Maya came back bringing some food, and Cortes gave back to them everything that Alvarado had stolen. Not because he was a sweet soft soul, but because he realized that he needed cooperation of the local population, at least initially, during this journey. He gave a speech translated by Melchior saying that sacrifices were bad and the local Maya gods were demons, and he wanted to bring them a better god. So as part of this, Cortes pushed down the statue of the Maya gods down the pyramids, breaking them, and the Maya were just left with their jaw hanging. At this point in the story, some Maya told Cortes that there were two Spaniards in villages not far away. Remember the Spaniards I mentioned to you a little while ago? Those who had shipwrecked a few years prior and had been living among the Maya? Well, we're about to meet them. Cortes sent Ordaz to look for them and gave a letter to be distributed to some of the local Maya chieftains in the towns where the Spaniards were supposed to be staying. The letter read, "Gentlemen and brothers, here in Cozumel, I've heard that you are captives. I beg you to come to this place at once, and for this purpose I've sent a ship with soldiers, in case you need them. Also a ransom to be given to those Indians with whom you are living. The ship will wait for you 8 days. Come as quickly as you can." And then he went to Isla Mujeres to wait. They waited for a while, but no one came. So then after Cortes left, he realized that one of his ships had a leak. So they went back to Cozumel to try to fix it. And it's at this point that they saw a canoe coming from the Yucatan Peninsula with three men in loincloths inside of it. One of them surprised everybody by screaming out in Spanish, saying, "Gentlemen, are you Christians? Whose subjects are you?" And when the reply was that yes, they were Spaniards, one of these three men in loincloths revealed himself as a Jerónimo de Aguilar. He was one of the Spaniards who had received Cortes' letter. Jerónimo de Aguilar had given the ransom to the chief of the town where he was at, and the chief had decided to let him go. By now, Aguilar was about 30 years old. He had been, in the spring of 1511, Aguilar had been on a ship under a certain Pedro de Valdivia, making their way from Panama to Santo Domingo to report to the governor there about some of the fights taking place among the Spanish captains in Panama. The ship had struck rocks and broken, so about 20 of them had jumped into lifeboats. But they had gone through hell on the ocean, because with no food and no water, they were caught in a current taking them west. Several of them died. Others survived, possibly by eating their companions. You thought there was a story without cannibalism? You would be wrong. Cannibalism show up again. Half of them arrived on the Yucatan Peninsula. They barely finished thanking their god that they made it, they had survived, when a group of Maya warriors arrived onto the beach, clubbed them senseless, dragged them back to their towns, where they promptly sacrificed Valdivia and several more. Aguilar and some of the others were placed in cages to be fattened for later sacrifice. Eventually, within weeks, all of them died, except for two of them, the same Aguilar we met and the Gonzalo Guerrero we are going to meet. The two of them broke out of the cages and escaped to a different Maya town. Not all the Mayas were political allies, so this different Maya town did not return them to their captors, but kept them as servants. Aguilar approaches servitude among the Maya with stoic faith. He kept praying to God because, he wasn't a slave in the nastiest way. They treated him as a servant. You have to do work, but he also treated him somewhat well. In many occasions, they also offered him women as a reward for his work. And Aguilar kept thinking, praying to God to avoid temptation of the women offered to him. He was very much ready to return to Spain. In the meantime, by the way, back in Spain, his poor mother, thinking that Aguilar had fallen prisoner of cannibals, she refused to eat meat and was freaked out anytime she saw meat cooking and would start screaming, "That is the flesh of my son!" So she had some PTSD going on pretty heavily. Aguilar at this point said, "Okay, so I found you. I'm glad to return to Spain with you guys, but let me go get my other friend. You know, he ended up being traded to a different town. I haven't seen him in a while, but I know where he is. Let me go catch Gonzalo Guerrero." So off he goes, saying, "Great news, Gonzalo, we are saved, we are saved." But the reaction he received from Gonzalo Guerrero was not exactly what he was expecting. Within this old tale of the Spanish conquest of Mexico, this is my favorite story of the entire narrative. It's a great reminder that individuals are not robots simply replicating the behavior expected by their culture. Culture influences people, but individuals get to choose whether they want to follow the culture that they were raised in or not. Aguilar, for example, was ecstatic to be saved by the Spaniards. He wanted to go back. Guerrero, not so much. His was the, in some way, the true historical Dances with Wolves story. One version of the story tells that he won his freedom by saving a Maya chieftain by an alligator attack. So that he had gained his freedom, he had gained renown as a experienced warrior among the Maya. He ended up being given the privilege of marrying the daughter of the Maya leader Nachan Khan, the lord of Chetumal. By the time Aguilar showed up saying, "We are saved, we are saved," Guerrero had three kids. He had become a military advisor to Nachan Khan, had his nose and ears pierced, had tattoos on his hands and on his face. And even in the 1500s, face tattoos were usually a point of no return. So Guerrero replied, "Brother Aguilar, I am married and have three children, and they look on me as a chief and a captain in time of war. Go, and God's blessing be with you. But my face is tattooed and my ears are pierced. What would the Spaniards say if they saw me like this? And look how handsome the children of mine are. Please give me some of those beads they have brought, and I will tell them that my brother sent them from my own country." This diplomatic speech was not quite the way Gonzalo's native wife, Maya wife, you know, she agreed with the message, he stays with us, but she was a bit angry about Aguilar's attempts to trying to convince her husband to leave her and go back to Spain. So she addressed Aguilar and said, "Why has this slave come here to call my husband away? Go off with you, and let us have no more of your talk." But Aguilar kept trying. He spoke to Guerrero again, reminding him that you are a good Christian. You should not destroy your soul for, I quote, "the sake of an Indian woman. And besides, if you really don't want to wish to desert your wife and kids, you can take them with you." But, the sources say, but neither words nor warnings could persuade Gonzalo to come. So, much of the tale, I mean, a lot of the whole history of Spanish indigenous interactions in the Americas is often an ugly one. You know, all of Latin America will basically be born from the unions of Spanish fathers and Indian mothers, but this most of the time did not happen in a pleasant way. Most of it was the product of rape, of Spanish lords enslaving Indian women, forcibly having sex with them, and then having kids with them. Guerrero is a powerful archetype because it's about a willing union, where a Maya woman and a Spanish man want to marry each other and have kids with one another. And these, according to the story, and again, it's hard to separate fact from legend, but according to this tale, these were the first mixed blood children to be born in the area of modern-day Mexico. According to writer Robert Chamberlain, he said that this pattern of trying to convince Guerrero repeat itself with later on, a few years later, somebody else trying to convince him and still not being able to do that. Now, the Guerrero story gets even more interesting now. The tale goes on to suggest that Guerrero was, you know, he by now had gone completely native. He would fight on the Maya side against the Spaniards for the years to come in order to preserve Maya independence. And in a letter written by a Spaniard to the Spanish king in 1536, there's the story of this one battle that took place between Pedro de Alvarado and the local Honduran chief. And they say that at the end of this battle, they found the body, the semi-naked body of this tattooed Spaniard, who was found among the dead for those fighting on the Maya side. And according to the author of this letter, this particular Spaniard had come over with 50 war canoes from Chetumal early in 1536 to help the local Maya fight the Spaniards who were attempting to colonize their lands. During the course of the battle, the Spaniard had been shot and killed. Although the author of the letter said that the Spaniard was named Gonzalo Aroca, Chamberlain and other historians writing about the event believe that this was the same Gonzalo Guerrero that Cortes had tried to get away from the Spaniards in 1519. Now, Guerrero is not going to play a big role in the story of the conquest of Mexico. You know, Aguilar is going to play a much more important role. But Guerrero is this powerful side story, telling us that the interaction between Spaniards and the local indigenous people was not predetermined. You know, there was no such thing as the Spaniards and the natives. There are different natives and different Spaniards who made their own choices. Aguilar made his choices, Guerrero made his choice, and his choice happened to be to become Maya, to side with the Maya, to father the first mixed-blood kids born from Spanish fathers and native women in the area of modern-day Mexico, and to kind of give up on his Spanish identity because he was now a full-fledged Maya. Tell something interesting about the meaning of race, ethnicity, identity. There's a lot to speak about in the story of Gonzalo Guerrero. This is really the real-life Dances with Wolves story. Now, the details of the story are hazy, to say the least, because sources are very thin on this, but this is nonetheless quite a powerful moment to take a break on. Let's end on a high note with this one, and we'll pick up back our narrative in the second part of this series when Cortes and these guys finally land on the coast of Mexico and find out much about the Mexica Empire that whets their appetite for conquest. But we'll save this for the next time, and we'll close for now with this very intriguing story of Mr. Gonzalo Guerrero. I want to extend a big thank you to BlueApron.com for choosing to sponsor one episode a month for the rest of the year. In the last few weeks, I've been eating Blue Apron meals like they are going out of style. In the past, I cook some of them and can testify to the ease of the process. But lately, its producer and editor of History on Fire, Savannah M., has been in charge of the cooking. And it has been so good. Every single time. I mean, I can't... It's kind of weird to be telling you how good the food I just had is if you don't get to taste it. So just take my word for it, or don't take my word for it, and try it out for yourself. Every Blue Apron delivery results in me jumping up and down in a less than dignified manner, but I don't care because I like the food that much. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. They have a very wide variety in their menus, and they allow for possibilities to customize it to your dietetic preference. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/onfire. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/onfire. Speaking of food, a gentleman named Leafar Guerrero, coincidentally, that's the same last name as the epic Gonzalo Guerrero we mentioned at the end of this episode. He has decided to sponsor this particular episode and ask if we can give a shout out to his Mexican restaurant in Silmar, California, in the LA San Fernando Valley. If you find yourself in the valley, go get a taste of his amazing food. And if not, please give a like to his Facebook page. I'll provide the link to his Facebook page in the episode notes. It's facebook.com/mamalichaskitchen, but in case you are confused by the spelling, by all means, I'll put it up in the episode notes at historyonfirepodcast.com. The good man is really not asking for much in exchange for helping keeping the podcast alive, so just please give a like to his Facebook page. On a non-food-related note, thank you to Geek Nation Tours. This time they will be traveling this October to feudal Japan and the battlefields of Sekigahara. Join them as they watch Kendo, Kyudo, Yaido and sword-making demonstration at the Seki Cutlery Festival. They'll visit a whole bunch of castles, Matsumoto, Ogaki, Nakahama, Nijo Castle, a whole, even the Himeji Castle, which is the most famous in all of Japan. They will hike the Magome Tsumago Trail, which is the very trail that samurai used in ancient Japan. They will also visit the Ryonji, the famous stone garden. They will see natural wonders like the Hirayu Waterfall and the Kamikochi Valley, and even bathe in private and public onsen. The biggest draw of the tour, however, is a visit to the Sekigahara Reenactment Festival, where you will see samurai walking the streets in full armor and battling in commemoration of the battle from the 1600s. Actually, not even the 1600s, the very year 1600. All information about this particular tour and the other tours that they offer will be found in the episode notes. I'll provide a link to their website, which is geeknationtours.com, but you know, like all the other links, it can be found at historyonfirepodcast.com. And of course, a big thank you to Onnit and Datsusara, the two companies who have been in my corner from day one. I use all their products on a daily basis. I just finished using Alpha Brain, which is kind of the flagship supplement that Onnit uses it. I just gave some to my dad, who was visiting from Italy, and he was... I didn't tell him much about Onnit beforehand, and he was a believer after trying Alpha Brain, because he said that it kind of made jet lag go away, kept him awake, kept him feeling mentally energized. So check that out. And also, if supplements are not your thing, they have a lot of other things, from exercise equipment to clothing to special foods. If you go to onnit.com/history, you'll automatically receive a 10% discount. And that's Usara. I mean, every single day I'm wearing some, in this very moment, I'm wearing a That's Usara hoodie that's made of hemp. Just as it's made of hemp, there are backpacks that I used right now. I'm in Big Bear, California. So as we were coming back up the mountain, all our gear was inside That's Usara backpacks. I really love their stuff. Check them out. You won't regret it. Their website is dsgear.com, and you can use the code Daniele at checkout for a discount. As usual, a big thank you to anyone who has been using the History on Fire Amazon link. There are lots of books that I've used to prepare these particular episodes. If you are interested in any of them, you can always buy them by using the History on Fire Amazon link. There's one named Conquest that's probably the number one source that anyone interested in the Spanish conquest of Mexico should check out. It's an excellent overview of the whole story. In any case, thank you so much for your patience, thank you for listening, and we'll touch base again next month for the second episodes in this four-part series.